From WBUR in Boston, it's Weekly Warm-Up, a sampling of the cornucopia of stories and interviews featured on Only a Game, sports public radio style.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new 240-horsepower turbocharged Acura RDX. More at acura.com/RDX.
Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. In the introduction to his new book, Playing with God, subtitled Religion and Modern Sport, William J. Baker maintains that religion and sport seem to have been made in the image of each other, an assertion that may come as no surprise to the many major league sluggers who point to the sky even as their home runs are clearing the fences. Those hitters may be less delighted with Dr. Baker's subsequent contention that religion and sport especially are joined at the altar of commercial interest. Bill Baker joins me now from the studios of Maine Public Radio in Bangor. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill.
What did you have in mind when you wrote that sports and religion were made in the image of each other?
Well, they're both born of passion. They're both born of discipline. They both thrive on spectacle of one sort or another. And they both thrive on ritual. Sport is filled with ritual just as religion is.
Of today's sports landscape, you write that evangelical religion and sport reinforce each other. I can see how an athlete under pressure might want to turn that pressure over to a higher power, but how does what happens on the field necessarily reinforce the athlete's beliefs?
Well, it's complex, but the evangelical athlete finds in his religion a kind of freedom to participate eagerly and enthusiastically, and really then, as it were, give it over to a higher power, that God will have his way and do his way. Moreover, the tradition recently of evangelicals in athletics is that athletics for them is a sort of podium for winning people to Christ, and athletics for them is that kind of platform and that kind of pitch.
You write that born-again Christians and athletes, quote, both hold a simple, clear-cut vision of reality that divides the world into winners and losers. Does that really hold true of athletes in general?
Well, I think especially American athletics is primarily given to winning and losing. Now, the old amateur scheme was that it's not whether you win or lose, but how you play the game. My take on that is that that's very un-American. Mm. It was a great Grantland Rice line from back in the 1920s, but very few people even in that day believed it, and I suspect scarcely anybody believes it anymore.
We've all seen basketball players cross themselves before they take a foul shot. We've seen football players kneeling on the sideline, holding hands with their teammates with their heads bowed. In circumstances like that, what distinguishes religion from superstition?
That's a very fine line. To call on God or the gods to bend the universe in your favor is a very audacious kind of enterprise. And whether you call it prayer and religion, or whether you call it superstition, there's always a fine line between those. So I don't think it's unique in sport. It is a part, I think, of the human condition that people grasp at whatever they can to make sense of their lives and to, as it were, shape their lives and their experience in a way that is to their advantage.
You point out that grafting nationalism to the partnership of religion and sport is a fairly recent development. How did that come about?
Well, it really began in the 19th century when nationalism boomed with flags and anthems and all kinds of references made to national states. It was after the Civil War in America when we survived the Civil War as a nation. It was also around the turn of the century into the 20th century where nation states everywhere were competing for dominance in their empires and in their wars. And religion became a part of the baggage of winning for God and winning for the nation state. In fact, it is to the point that it's only in the early 20th century that a national anthem was first sung in America. It was not until then that anybody considered using flags at sporting events and wrapping the nationalism into the religion.
And then, of course, the next step is not only the flags and the songs, but the jet fighters overhead as well.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And all of that also is then a commercial package, of course. And, you know, the Super Bowl is one of the great extravagant spectacles, and I would say rituals, in American life. And it is just permeated with religious symbols and nationalistic symbols and materialistic symbols.
Do you think that most fans tuning in to watch the Super Bowl, since that's the example that you've used, are aware that they're getting that entire package of nationalism, religion, as well as sport?
No, I think it would diminish probably the impact of it if they did. And I wouldn't suggest that there are hidden persuaders out there doing anything secretly to people, but most of what we do is not conscious. Most of what we do is visceral. It is not intellectual. It is not reflective. It is repetitive, ritualistic, fantasy. And that's what makes it effective. That's what in the past has always made religion effective. I would contend that in the present is what makes sport effective, and most certainly what makes patriotism effective.
It's significant, I think, that you choose to end your book not with the example of Barry Bonds, although there is a picture toward the end of the book of Bonds pointing to the sky, but you end it with a discussion of a coach of whom most of our listeners will certainly never have heard. Tell us a little bit about Linda Head Flanagan.
She is a high school track coach in a little school in New Jersey, and she is trying to explain why she does this. She's part-time. She's paid very poorly. She has two or three kids of her own. She has to leave them to go do her work. She gets flack from parents and some flack from her own athletes, of course. And so she, I think, wisely asks, why the devil am I breaking my neck to do this crazy job of coaching high school track to these girls. I believe it may even be a private school. But she comes out saying at the end that she does it because she wants these girls to know that life is doable and that they can achieve and that they can be all that they might think they would like to be. Essentially, that life is more than track and that their experience and their lives are more than athletics of any sort. And indeed, any interaction that takes place in high school.
So perhaps for the most fortunate of young athletes, the ideal lives.
The ideal does live for some. And I would say it lived for me in North Georgia back in the 50s. I had a wonderful high school football coach who was a human being, a good person. He happened to be the deacon in the First Baptist Church. He was more concerned about us than he was about winning, and we happened to go on and win two state championships. But the gods were kind in that regard. But I experienced that. One of the grandest gifts from God is for any athlete, high school, college, or wherever, to work under and with a coach who is sensible and sensitive and decent, and more power to them.
William J. Baker is the author of Playing with God, subtitled Religion and Modern Sport, published by Harvard University Press. Dr. Baker joined me from the studios of Maine Public Radio in Bangor. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
As the riders competing in the Tour de France shifted into climbing mode late this week, commentator Alyssa Eli found her thoughts turning to pedaling as well. Her aspirations were more humble. Nevertheless, the experience was frustrating.
You head out on a bike ride hoping for a little meditative time, maybe some aerobic exercise. It's all part of a grand plan to shave down the creeping body mass index. But other things happen while you're making plans. I took the local bike path. It's one of the oldest in the country, 11 miles in each direction. It ends on the tracks of a commuter rail line, which is convenient if you need help getting home. There's a white line down the middle of the path. Etiquette signs are posted everywhere. Stay in line, single file, let faster riders pass. These are sensible rules for human beings sharing life's road. Younger riders sped past, shouting in terse biker dialect, "On your left, your left, your left." It's not restful to hear, but it's proper. They are stronger and faster and have the right to the center of the road. Riders coming in the other direction also pass on the left, which meant my lane was becoming quickly crowded. Some bikers didn't even mean to pass. They were just ambling along in groups of twos and threes, fanned out, chatting. To accommodate them, I was forced over, farther and farther right. This is against my political inclinations and certainly against the rules. By mile 5, I was unsettled. By mile 8, I was steaming. If one more chatty group crowded me for their own pleasure, I'd be off the road and in the gully. The group in question approached. There were 4 of them, side by side, speaking to each other animatedly, not a bit interested in propriety or oncoming traffic. They were not in line. They were not in single file. They did not care. Enough was enough. With some deep rage summoned on behalf of all bikers edged off bike paths, I screamed in the coarsest middle-aged voice I could manage, "Get off my side!" It was a satisfying moment. I felt Vesuvius had spoken. The 4 looked at me in shock. Probably no one had ever brought them to justice before. "Good," one said something to the rest. I cycled closer to hear the response. Once and for all, they needed to understand. The only problem was, they weren't speaking English.
Alyssa Eli is a psychiatrist and writer who's regularly featured on Only a Game. On Tuesday, sports agent Gustavo Dominguez was sentenced to 5 years in prison for smuggling Cuban baseball players into the United States. According to prosecutors, Dominguez paid $225,000 to a small-time drug trafficker to run 5 Cuban ball players in a fast boat from Cuba to Big Pine Key, a stretch of beach 30 miles north of Key West. To avoid Major League Baseball's rules that require players from Cuba to enter the amateur draft, 3 of Dominguez's charges traveled to the Dominican Republic and became free agents. Numerous Cuban players, Jose Contreras, for example, and El Duque Hernandez, have found their way to Major League teams by similar means, but nobody had previously been prosecuted for aiding them in their flight from Cuba or for helping them find work in baseball in the U.S. Joining me now is Roberto Gonzalez Echevarria, Sterling Professor of Hispanic and Comparative Literatures at Yale University and author of Pride of Havana, A History of Cuban Baseball. Professor Gonzalez Echevarria, welcome back to Only a Game.
Well, I'm very happy to be here with you.
It used to be that Cuban athletes defected during overseas tournaments. This was a fairly common occurrence, rather than paying smugglers and risking the open seas. Why did that change?
Well, because they have clamped down, and hence it has become very difficult for them to bolt to freedom. I hate the word defect. They have clamped down. I mean, during the so-called baseball classic, I have information that the players were kept as prisoners. When they were in Puerto Rico, the hotel rooms had no telephones or televisions, and they were being followed constantly by security agents. But others have continued to leave from teams. For instance, recently, I think it was a wrestler in Germany, for instance. And then, of course, there are these 2 soccer players who recently left their team here in a tournament.
Well, those are the 2 guys I next wanted to talk about. Lester Moray and Osvaldo Alonso are trying out this week with Chivas USA. Alonso walked away from his teammates while they were shopping at a mall in Houston a few days after Moray left the team in New Jersey. Why were they so easily able to get away? Is it just that they're not paying as much attention to soccer players as they have been to baseball players?
Of course, yeah. I mean, soccer is not a very important sport in Cuba, and the Cuban soccer teams do not do very well. So they focus on baseball because it's one of the propaganda icons of the regime.
Mm-hmm.
So they want to keep the players there and avoid a scandal. I mean, when someone like El Duque or Contreras or even Kendry Morales escapes, it's news. Well, these 2 guys, no one's really paying attention to them. I don't know if they'll be able to make it in soccer here. I mean, soccer was very big in Cuba in the 1920s and the 30s, but it hasn't been in the last 50 or 60 years.
The team for which these two Cuban players are trying out, Chivas USA, has only one roster spot available currently, and there's no guarantee that either player will be chosen to fill it. Similarly, a number of baseball players who've come here with the dream of playing in the big leagues have not made major league rosters. What happens to those who don't succeed in finding a job in pro sports?
I'm sure that they are very happy to be here, to be free, and to go on with their lives. I mean, what happens to them when their career is over in Cuba? They have no no future, and they live in poverty, and also, of course, in a repressive atmosphere. So I'm sure that there have been over 100 baseball players who have left Cuba in the last 20 years or so, and only a few have made it to the major leagues. I remember one who was working in a grocery store in Miami with whom I communicated. Betancourt was his name. He was an older man. He left during the Baltimore-Cuba game. He was a coach, and he couldn't get much because, of course, he was beyond playing age. So he was not worth much in sports terms, but he was happy to be here. Others have, you know, have joined little academies in Miami to teach kids how to play baseball and so forth. I mean, what happens to the many Americans who don't make it to the major league?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
The Cuban exile community is said to view Gus Dominguez as a heroic figure, and several well-known retired ballplayers, including former Dodger pitcher Sandy Koufax, wrote to the judge on behalf of Dominguez. I wonder, do you know whether that had any impact on the sentence Mr. Dominguez received?
There was a mandatory minimum sentence. So when you're dealing with a mandatory sentence, there's very little a judge can do. I think that he was lenient in the sense that he imposed the minimum mandatory sentence. And in that sense, the letters from Koufax and some of the others may have helped.
Do you think the prosecution of Gus Dominguez is likely to change the way smugglers, agents, and ballplayers in Cuba have been doing business?
I don't know. There was another one who was prosecuted in Cuba for trying to smuggle players out. He was working for one of the agents in Miami, and I think he's currently in jail in Cuba. I would have to look that up. But no, I think that people will continue to try to escape from Cuba as the situation deteriorates further, if that is possible. And the current situation is really as bad as it has been in the past 49 years. So people will always try to escape, not just ball players. I mean, people are escaping to Central America and Mexico in rickety boats. It's going to be interesting to see what happens now in Brazil, in the Pan American Games. Cuba is sending a team with the cream of their ballplayers, many of whom played in the Classic. I'm sure they're going to be very, very closely guarded. But, I mean, someone like Yulieski Gurriel, the second baseman, who's supposed to be one of the better players in Cuba, he's getting to be 23, 24. So they must feel a great deal of pressure to leave and to make something of themselves as soon as possible. I see that Escobar, for instance, is doing very well with the Braves, an infielder. I don't know if you've been following him. Escobar, they say, is excellent, and he has broken into a very, very good lineup. And he was playing, I don't think he was even a first-string player with Industriales. So there are a lot of players in Cuba who would have a chance, and I'm sure that they're going to try to continue to leave by whichever way.
Major League Baseball's policy regarding Cuban ballplayers seems to encourage illegal smuggling of players. Should Major League Baseball take some of the responsibility for what's been going on here?
Well, I don't know if it encourages it. I mean, it encourages by just existing, by just being there. And it's near enough. That is, I mean, if Japan were within an easy trip of the United States, other players would go to Japan. I don't know what Major League Baseball could do not to be a lure to these players. I mean, I would not be in favor of discouraging the players from coming here, as I'm not in favor of some of these laws, such as the ones applied to Dominguez, that discourage people from trying to pull Cubans out of Cuba.
Roberto Gonzalez Echeverria is the author of Pride of Havana, A History of Cuban Baseball. Professor Gonzalez Echeverria, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure.
If you want to know which NASCAR driver has the best setup or who is the top-ranked fencer, male or female, you need to go no further than Charlie Pierce, who's in NPR's New York Bureau, for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Everyone's favorite NBA owner, Mark Cuban, has applied to buy the Chicago Cubs. The Chicago Tribune heralded this development by saying, "Most observers think Major League Baseball would balk at a potential owner as unpredictable and outspoken as Cuban." Cuban has refused to comment because most observers were not named. So, Charlie, what the heck? You're an observer. Are you willing to go on the record?
I was really worried that there would never be another context in which Mark Cuban could be an insufferable know-nothing blowhard. Phew! What a relief! There are the Cubs!
This week, the Yankees announced that they are willing to break precedent and negotiate an extension for Alex Rodriguez during the season. Representing Mr. Rodriguez, Scott Boras announced that his client doesn't feel like negotiating right now. He just expects to be paid more than $30 million a year from now on. So what a good way to start discussions, huh?
Well, there's no compelling reason for Alex Rodriguez, given the season he's having. There's no compelling reason for him to negotiate till after this wonderful season is over, when he has every bit of leverage he can possibly have. I mean, he's not particularly devoted to the concept of being a Yankee, since he hasn't exactly embraced or been embraced by the city of New York. So I think he's going to put the Yankees on a spit and slow roast them until the end of November.
Ricky Henderson has joined the Mets as their new hitting coach. So how many of the current Mets will soon be hitting leadoff home runs?
Well, that's an interesting thing. People forget that the great gift and the great wonder of Ricky Henderson was the amount of power he had. I think if he keeps his mind on his job, he'll be a terrific addition to a very good young lineup.
How long before he requests that they activate him?
No, he won't. I asked somebody that today. I honestly believe he doesn't want to be activated.
The New York Mets cut the man who had been rumored as a possible contender for the job Henderson took. 48-year-old Julio Franco was replaced this week by an outfielder less than half his age, so probably the last we'll see of Julio.
Mother of mercy, is this the end of Julio? I thought he was going to make it to 50. I was kind of rooting for him to make it to 50, to play in the major leagues when he's 50. I don't know. Are you telling me that Tampa Bay Devil Rays couldn't use him? There are three teams in the American League East that could use Julio Franco, including the Yankees, I might add. I've got to think he's going to hook on somewhere for a few games.
On Wednesday, Charlie, it was reported that Oklahoma must, quote, vacate its 2005 football season after failing to monitor two players who were paid for work they did not do at a Norman car dealership. What does vacate mean in this context, and how much does a punishment like this really hurt a major football school?
Well, it means you don't get your security deposit back from the NCAA, which is really a terrible thing for smaller schools, but not such a big deal for Oklahoma. It means the five wins they had in that season don't count anymore. Basically, it means that the season didn't happen, basically. And the five wins that you profited by and whatever TV revenues came from them, you don't have them anymore.
Don Nelson, who has 2 years remaining on his $6.2 million contract to coach the Golden State Warriors, wishes to be paid more money to do that job. Does he have a case for requesting a raise?
No, he sort of does in the same way that raises are doled out in professional sports. He's always been very impressed with his own ability. I predict that this will not end well in Golden State for him.
Speaking of millions of dollars, a former women's volleyball coach from Fresno State, fired in 2004, was awarded $5.8 million this week in what was apparently the largest settlement ever granted to a coach suing for retaliation under Title IX. Was this case an anomaly, or do Title IX advocates have reason to celebrate?
Well, they have a couple of reasons to celebrate this week. They have this case, which is a vindication for them, and they have a General Accountability Office report that seems to back up their notion of continuing gender inequity in college sports. This is a huge verdict, both for the advocates of Title IX and for this woman in specific, but it's also a further indication of how far down the big major sport rabbit hole Fresno State fell over the last 15 years. It started when they hired Jerry Tarkanian, whom everybody knew was going to get in trouble, to run their basketball program, and it just hasn't stopped.
Earlier this week, during a practice session at the Pan Am Games, a Brazilian fencer was accidentally stabbed by his brother. Surgery was required, and the fencer in question had to drop from the games, although I gather he's okay now. I thought this kind of thing only happened in Hamlet.
No, it happens a lot. Generally, what happens is one of the fencer's blades will break, and he will continue with his action with a jagged and broken blade, and that will do the damage. There's a very famous episode about 20 years ago between a German fencer and a Russian fencer where the blade broke and went through the mask of the Russian fencer and killed him on the spot.
Oof.
And the German fencer in question, who's a very, very talented fencer, wound up in an institution for a while coping with it. So while it's very unusual, it does happen.
Having discovered that a limited number of U.S. citizens care about professional ice hockey, the National Hockey League announced this week that the Anaheim Ducks will play the Los Angeles Kings in London on September 29th, almost exactly 1 month before the NFL plays a regular season game in Wembley Stadium. This sounds to me kind of like when the younger sister announces her wedding for the week before her older sister.
That's right. This is pure spite on the NHL's part. But I will tell you, I believe firmly that having an NHL game in London makes infinitely more sense than having two NHL teams in Florida.
The league's public relations strategy also involves staging a game outdoors on New Year's Day. No competition for the sports fans' attention on New Year's Day, right?
Do you suppose they just didn't Google it? Let's just January 1, sure, just throw it out there. Nothing else is going on.
Right,
Everybody's hungover. Well, they'll watch an outdoor hockey game when there are 57 bowl games to be played.
David Beckham was officially introduced to U.S. soccer fans in Los Angeles yesterday, Charlie, and the Galaxy reported
that... And all five of them were there!
Now, take it easy. 250,000 people have already ordered Beckham jerseys, even though they didn't know what the jerseys would look like at the time. I guess they were just confident in the sartorial taste of the Galaxy's design staff. It must have been it.
That's the event. Now we'll see whether it actually sells the sport. You know, he'll have the one time around the league. He'll be, hey, David Beckham is coming to Columbus, and there'll be, you know, David Beckham Day in Columbus, and then we'll see the second time around the league whether or not he gets incomprehensibly bored by the American soccer climate or whether or not he can do what he's been brought here to do.
All right, which do you think is more embarrassing for 14-year-old Wycota Fisher, a soon-to-be freshman at Yorktown High School in Texas? A, being the only kid cut from the cheerleading squad, or B, having her mother sue the school for cutting her, thus letting the world know that she was the only kid cut from the cheerleading squad?
Obviously, the second is the more embarrassing of the two. But this, you have to understand, this is a vast improvement in the way moms in Texas react to their daughters being cut from cheerleading squad. Because the last one of these stories we had, the mom tried to kill the other kid.
Yes, exactly. The World Schools Debating Championships crowned a champion this week, Charlie, and Sean Connery. Sean Connery was no doubt pleased by the result of the competition.
No, he wasn't. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's not a debate. That's an argument.
No, I'm sorry. Well, debate's down the hall. Actually, yes, the Scots managed to overcome the feisty Kuwaitis in the World Finals. On the subject resolved, if it's not Scottish, it's cop.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks for listening to Only a Game. Please check your local listings for the NPR station nearest you to carry our show, and please visit our website, onlyagame.org.